threats, or beatings. Periods of imprisonment had done nothing but temporarily change the environment in which he conducted business. Half the boys with whom he had associated in his teens were dead, most killed by knives or overdoses. One cousin had died in a police car chase, another had been shot through the back of the head, his killer never caught.
"You had to make a delivery,"
Strike went on, trying to jog Shanker's memory.
"Jiffy bag full of something. Drugs, cash, I don't know. You came round the squat looking for someone to drive you, urgently. I said I'd do it. We went to a strip club in Soho. It was called Teasers."
"Teasers, yeah," said Shanker. "Long gone Teasers. Closed 10, 15 years ago.
When we got there, there was a group of men standing on the pavement heading inside. One of them was a bald black guy."
"Your fucking memory," said Shanker, amused. "You could do a stage act. Bunsen, the amazing memory man."
"And there was a big Latin-looking bloke with dyed black hair and sideburns. We pulled up, you wound down the window, and he came over and put his hand on the door to talk to you. He had eyes like a basset hound, and he was wearing a massive gold ring with a lion's..."
"Mucky Ritchie," said Shanker.
"You remember him?"
"Just said his name, Bunsen, didn't I?"
"Yeah, sorry. What was his real name, do you know?"
"Nico. Niccolo Ritchie. But everyone called him Mucky. Old school villain, pimp. He owned a few strip clubs, ran a couple of knocking shops. Real bit of old London, he was. Got his start as part of the Sabini gang when he was a kid."
"How are you spelling Ritchie? R-I-C-C-I, right?
What's this about?"
Strike tugged the copy of Whatever Happened to Margot Bamber out of his coat pocket, turned to the photographs of the practice Christmas party, and held it out to Shanker, who took it suspiciously. He squinted for a moment at the partial picture of the man with the lion ring, then passed the book back to Strike.
"Well?"
said Strike.
"Yeah, looks like him. Where's that?"
"Clerkenwell. A doctor's Christmas party."
Shanker looked mildly surprised.
"Well, Clerkenwell, that was the old Sabini stamping ground, weren't it? And I suppose even gangsters need doctors sometimes."
"It was a party," said Strike, "not a surgery. Why would Mucky Ritchie be at a doctor's party?"
"Dunno," said Shanker. "Anyone need killing?"
"Funny you should ask that," said Strike. "I'm investigating the disappearance of a woman who was there that night."
Shanker looked sideways at him.
"Mucky Ritchie's gaga," he said quietly. "Old man now, innit?"
"Still alive, though?"
"Yeah. He's in an home."
"How do you know that?"
"Done a bit of business with his eldest, Luca."
"Boys in the same line of work as their old man?"
"Well, there ain't no Little Italy gang anymore, is there? But they're villains, yeah," said Shanker.
Then he leaned across the table and said quietly,
"Listen to me, Bunsen. You do not want to screw with Mucky Ritchie's boys."
It was the first time Shanker had ever given Strike such a warning.
"You go fucking with their old man. You try pinning anything on him, the Ritchie boys will skin you, understand? They don't fucking care. They'll torch your fucking office. They'll cut up your girl."
"Tell me about Mucky. Anything you know."
"Did you hear what I just said, Bunsen?"
"Just tell me about him, for fuck's sake."
Shanker scowled.
"Hookers, porn, drugs. But girls was his main thing. Same era as George Cornell, Jimmy Humphries, all those boys. That gold ring he wore, he used to say Danny the Lion gave it him. Danny Leo, the mob boss in New York. Claimed they were related. Don't know if it's true."
"Ever run across anyone called Conti?" Strike asked. "Probably a bit younger than Ritchie."
"Nope. But Luca Ritchie's a fucking psycho," said Shanker. "When did this bint disappear?"
1974, said Strike.
He expected Shanker to say,
1974,
to pour scorn on the likelihood of finding any kind of solution after all this time. But his old friend merely frowned at him, his clicking fingers recalling the relentless progress of the Death Watch Beetle, and it occurred to the detective that Shanker knew more about old crimes and the long shadows they cast than many policemen.
"Name of Margot Bamber," said Strike. She vanished on her way to the pub. Nothing ever found. No handbag, door keys, nothing. Never seen again.
Shanker sipped his beer.
Professional job, he said.
That occurred to me, said Strike. Hence...
Fuck your fucking hints, said Shanker fiercely. If the bint was taken out by Mucky Ritchie or any of his boys, she's past fucking saving, isn't she? I know you like being a Boy Scout, mate, but the last guy who pissed off Luca Ritchie, his wife opened the door a few days later and got acid thrown in her face. Blind in one eye now. You want to drop this, Bunsen? If Mucky Ritchie's the answer, you need to stop asking the question.
Chapter 28. Greatly thereat was Britomart dismayed. Nay, in that stoned whist, how herself to bear. Edmund Spenser, The Fairy Queen. Somehow, Pat had managed to track down a vintage film projector. It had been promised for delivery at 4, but Strike and Robin were still waiting for it at 5:45, at which time Robin told Strike she really did need to leave. She hadn't yet packed for her trip home to Yorkshire. She wanted an early night before catching the train, and if she was honest, she was feeling insulted by Strike's gift of unwrapped salted caramel chocolates, which he'd pulled hastily out of a Liberty bag when he saw her, and which now she suspected was the whole lousy reason he had forced her to come back to the office in the first place. As this had necessitated a long trip back to Denmark Street on a packed tube, it was hard not to feel resentful about the time and trouble she had taken to find and wrap the DVD of two old Tom Waits concerts he'd mentioned wanting to watch a few weeks previously. Robin had never heard of the singer. It had taken her some trouble to identify the man Strike had been talking about, and the concerts he'd never seen as those on No Visitors After Midnight. And in return, she got chocolate she was sure had been grabbed at random. She left Strike's present behind, untouched, in Max's kitchen, before boarding the crowded train to Harrogate next morning. As she travelled north in her mercifully pre-booked seat, Robin tried to tell herself that her feeling of emptiness was merely tiredness. Christmas at home would be a wonderful break. She'd be meeting her new niece for the first time. There'd be lions and home-cooked food and hours in front of the telly. A toddler was shouting at the back of the carriage, his mother trying just as loudly to entertain and subdue him. Robin pulled out her iPod and put on headphones. She'd downloaded Joni Mitchell's album Caught and Spark, which Una had mentioned as Margot Bamber's favourite. Robin hadn't yet had time to listen to it, or indeed, to any other music for weeks. But Caught and Spark didn't soothe or cheer her. She found it unsettling, unlike anything she had ever listened to before. Expecting melodies and hooks, Robin was disappointed. Everything felt unfinished, left open, unresolved. A beautiful soprano voice tumbled and swooped over piano or guitar chords that never led to anything as mundane as a chorus that you could settle into or tap your foot to. You couldn't hum along. You couldn't have joined in unless you, too, could sing like Mitchell, which Robin certainly couldn't. The words were strange, and invoked responses she didn't like. She wasn't sure she'd ever felt the things Mitchell sang about, and this made her feel defensive, confused, and sad. Love came to my door, with a sleeping roll and a madman's soul. A few seconds into track 3, she turned off the iPod and reached instead for the magazine she had brought with her. At the back of the carriage, the toddler was now howling. Robin's mood of mild despondency persisted until she got off the train, but when she saw her mother standing on the platform, ready to drive her back to Masham, she was overtaken by a wave of genuine warmth. She hugged Linda, and for almost 10 minutes afterwards, while they wended their way, chatting, towards the car, passing a cafe out of which jangling Christmas music was emanating, even the dour grey Yorkshire skies and the car interior, which smelled of Rowntree the Labrador, felt comforting and cheery in their familiarity.
"I've got something to tell you," Linda said,
when she had closed the driver's door. Instead of turning the key in the ignition, Linda turned to Robin, looking almost fearful. A sickening jolt of panic turned Robin's stomach upside down.
"What's happened?" she said.
"It's all right," Linda said hastily. "Everyone's well. But I want you to know before we get back to Masham, in case you see them."
"See who?"
"Matthew," said Linda, he's brought that woman home with him, Sarah Shadlock. They're staying with Geoffrey for Christmas."
"Oh,"
said Robin. "Christ, Mum, I thought someone had died." She hated the way Linda was looking at her. Though her insides had just grown cold, and the fragile happiness that had briefly kindled inside her had been snuffed out, she forced a smile and a tone of unconcern.
"It's fine, I knew. Her ex-fiancé called me. I should have guessed," she said, wondering why she hadn't.
"They might be here for Christmas.
Can we get home, please? I'm dying for a cup of tea."
"You knew? Why didn't you tell us?" But Linda herself supplied the answer to that as they drove. It neither soothed nor comforted Robin to have Linda storming about how outraged she'd been when a neighbour told her that Matthew had been strolling hand in hand with Sarah through the middle of the town. She didn't feel comforted by strictures against her ex-husband's morals and manners, nor did she appreciate having each family member's reaction detailed to her. Martin was all for punching him again. Then Linda moved on to the divorce. What was going on? Why wasn't it all settled yet? Did Robin honestly think mediation would work? Didn't Matthew's behaviour, flaunting this woman in front of the whole of Masham, show how utterly lost to shame and reason he was? Why, oh why, hadn't Robin agreed to let Harvey's of Harrogate deal with it all? Was she sure this London woman was up to it, because Corin Maxwell had told Linda that when her daughter divorced without children, it was all completely straightforward? But at least there was little Annabel Marie, with the conclusion of Linda's monologue, as they turned onto Robin's parent street. "Wait till you see her, Robin. Just wait." The front door opened before the car came to a halt. Jenny and Stephen were standing on the threshold, looking so excited that an onlooker might have suspected it was they who were about to see their baby daughter for the first time, not Robin. Realizing what was expected of her, Robin hitched an eager smile onto her face, and within minutes found herself sitting on the sofa in her parents' living room, a warm little sleeping body in her arms, wrapped up in wool, surprisingly solid and heavy, and smelling of Johnson's baby powder.
"She's gorgeous, Stephen," Robin said,
while Roundtree's tail thumped against the coffee table. He was nosing at her, thrusting his head repeatedly under Robin's hand, confused as to why he wasn't receiving the fuss and love he was used to.
"She's gorgeous, Jenny," Robin said,
as her sister-in-law took photos of Auntie Robin meeting Annabel for the first time.
"She's gorgeous, Mum,"
Robin said to Linda, who had come back with a tea tray and a craving to hear what Robin thought of their 20-inch-long marvel.
"Evens things out, doesn't it, having another girl?" said Linda delightedly.
Her anger at Matthew was over now. Her granddaughter was everything. The sitting room was more cramped than usual, not only with Christmas trees and cards, but with baby equipment. A changing mat, a Moses basket, a pile of mysterious muslin cloth, a bag of nappies, and an odd contraption that Jenny explained was a breast pump. Robin rhapsodized, smiled, laughed, ate biscuits, heard the story of the birth, admired some more, held her niece until she woke, then, after Jenny had taken back possession of the baby, and with a touch of new self-importance, settled herself down to breastfeed, said that she would nip upstairs and unpack. Robin carried her bag upstairs, her absence unnoticed and unregretted by those below, who were lost in adoration of the baby. Robin closed the door of her old room behind her, but instead of unpacking, lay down on her old bed. Facial muscles aching from all her forced smiling, she closed her eyes and allowed herself the luxury of exhausted misery. Chapter 29. Thus warred he long time against his will, till that through weakness he was forced at last to yield himself unto the mighty ill, which, as a victor proud, gan ransack fast his inward parts and all his entrails waste. Edmund Spenser, The Fairy Queen. With 3 days to go before Christmas, Strike was forced to abandon the pretense that he didn't have flu. Concluding that the only sensible course was to hole up in his attic flat while the virus passed through his system, he took himself to a packed Sainsbury's where, feverish, sweating, breathing through his mouth, and desperate to get away from the crowds and the canned carols, he grabbed enough food for a few days and bore it back to his two rooms above the office. Joan took the news that he wouldn't be joining the festivities in Cornwall predictably hard. She went so far as to suggest that it would be fine for him to come, as long as they sat at opposite ends of the dinner table. But to Strike's relief, Ted overruled her. Strike didn't know whether he was being paranoid, but he suspected Lucy didn't believe he was genuinely ill. If she did, her tone suggested that he might have caught flu deliberately. He thought he heard a trace of accusation when she informed him that Joan was now entirely bald. By 5 o'clock in the afternoon of Christmas Eve, Strike had developed a cough that made his lungs rattle and his ribs ache. Drowsing on his bed in a T-shirt and boxer shorts, his prosthetic leg propped against a wall, he was woken abruptly by a loud noise. Footsteps seemed to be moving down the stairs, away from his attic door. A paroxysm of coughing seized him before he could call out to the person he thought had woken him. Struggling back into a sitting position to clear his lungs, he didn't hear the second approach of footsteps until somebody knocked on his door. He greatly resented the effort it took to shout,
"What?"
"Do you need anything?" came Pat's deep, gravelly voice.
"No,"
Strike shouted. The syllable emerged as a croak.
"Have you got food?"
"Yes."
"Painkillers?"
"Yes."
"Well, I'm leaving some things outside the door for you."
He heard her setting objects down.
"There are a couple of presents. Eat the soup while it's still hot. See you on the 28th.
Her footsteps were clanging down the metal stairs before he could respond. He wasn't sure whether he'd imagined the mention of hot soup, but the possibility was enough to make him drag his crutches towards himself and make his way laboriously to the door. The chill of the stairwell added goose flesh to his fever sweats. Pat had somehow managed to carry the old video projector upstairs for him, and he suspected that it was the sound of her setting this down that had woken him. Beside it lay the can of film from Gregory Talbot's attic, a small pile of wrapped Christmas gifts, a handful of cards, and 2 polystyrene tubs of hot chicken soup that he knew she must have walked to Chinatown to fetch. He felt quite pathetically grateful. Leaving the heavy projector and the can of film where they were, he pulled and prodded the Christmas gifts and card across the floor into the flat with one of his crutches, then slowly bent down to pick up the tubs of soup. Before eating, he took his mobile from the bedside table and texted Pat. "Thanks very much. Hope you have a good Christmas." He then wrapped a duvet around himself and ate the soup straight out of the tubs, tasting nothing. He'd hoped the hot liquid would soothe his raw throat, but the cough persisted, and once or twice he thought he was going to choke everything back up again. His intestines also seemed unsure whether they welcomed food. Having finished the 2 tubs, he settled back down beneath the duvet, sweating while he looked at the black sky outside, guts churning, and wondering why he wasn't yet on the mend. After a night of intermittent dozing, interrupted by prolonged coughing fits, Strike woke on Christmas morning to find his fever unabated and sweaty sheets tangled about him. His normally noisy flat was unnaturally quiet. Tottenham Court Road was suddenly weirdly devoid of traffic. He supposed most of the taxi drivers were at home with their families. Strike was not a self-pitying man, but lying alone in bed, coughing and sweating, his ribs sore, and his fridge now virtually empty, he was unable to prevent his thoughts roaming back over Christmases past, especially those spent at Ted and Joan's in St. Maur's, where everything proceeded as it did on the television and in storybooks, with turkey and crackers and stockings. Of course, today was far from the first Christmas he'd spent away from family and friends. There had been a couple such in the army, when he'd eaten foil trays of tasteless turkey in field canteens, among camouflage-wearing colleagues wearing Santa hats. The structure he'd enjoyed in the military had then consoled him in the absence of other pleasures. But there was no camaraderie to sustain him today. Only the dismal fact that he was alone, ill, and one-legged, stuck up in a drafty attic, forced to endure the consequences of his own firm repudiation of any relationship that might offer support in moments of illness or sadness. The memory of Pat's kindness became, this Christmas morning, still more touching in retrospect. Turning his head, he saw the few gifts that she'd brought upstairs still lying on the floor just inside the door. He got up from his bed, still coughing, reached for his crutches, and swung himself towards the bathroom. His urine was dark, his unshaven face in the mirror ashen. Though dismayed by his own debility and exhaustion, habits ingrained in him by the military prevented Strike from returning to bed. He knew that lying unwashed with his leg off would merely increase his hovering feeling of depression. He therefore showered, moving more carefully than usual to guard against the risk of falls, dried himself off, put on a clean T-shirt, boxers and dressing gown, and, still racked with coughs, prepared himself a tasteless breakfast of porridge made with water, because he preferred to conserve his last pint of milk for his tea. As he'd expected to be well on the mend by now, his stocks of food had dwindled to some limp vegetables, a couple of bits of uncooked chicken 2 days out of date, and a small chunk of hard cheddar. After breakfast, Strike took painkillers, put on his prosthesis, and then, determined to use what small amount of physical strength he could muster before the illness dragged him under again, stripped and remade his bed with clean sheets, removed his Christmas presents from the floor to his kitchen table, and carried the projector and roll of film inside from the landing where he had left them. The can, as he'd expected, bore the mark of Capricorn upon it, drawn in faded but clearly legible marker pen. His mobile buzzed as he propped the can against the wall beneath his kitchen window. He picked it up, expecting a text from Lucy asking when he was going to call and wish everyone in St. Maur's a Merry Christmas. "Merry Christmas, Bluey. Are you happy? Are you with someone you love?" It had been a fortnight since Charlotte had last texted him, almost as though she telepathically heard his resolution to contact her husband if her messages became any more self-destructive. It would be so easy to answer. So easy to tell her he was alone, ill, unsupported. He thought of the naked photo she'd sent on his birthday, which he'd forced himself to delete. But he'd come such a long way, to a place of lonely security against emotional storms. However much he'd loved her, however much she could still disturb his serenity with a few typed words, he forced himself, standing beside his small formica table, to recall the only occasion on which he'd taken her back to St. Maur's for Christmas. He remembered the row heard all through the tiny house, remembered her storming out past the family assembled around the turkey, remembered Ted and Joan's faces because they'd so looked forward to the visit, having not seen Strike for over a year, because he was at that time stationed in Germany with the Special Investigation Branch of the Royal Military Police. He set his mobile to mute. Self-respect and self-discipline had always been his bulwarks against lethargy and misery. What was Christmas Day, after all? If you disregarded the fact that other people were enjoying feasts and fun, merely a winter's day like any other. If he was currently bodily weak, why shouldn't he use his mental faculties at least to continue work on the Bamborough case? Thus reasoning, Strike made himself a fresh cup of strong tea, added a very small amount of milk, opened his laptop, and, pausing regularly for coughing fits, reread the document he'd been working on before he'd fallen ill. A summary of the contents of Bill Talbot's symbol-laden, leather-bound notebook, which Strike had now spent 3 weeks deciphering. His intention was to send the document to Robin for her thoughts. Talbot's occult notes. 1. Overview. 2. Symbol key. 3. Possible leads. 4. Probably irrelevant. 5. Action points. Overview. Talbot's breakdown manifested itself in a belief that he could solve the Bamborough case by occult means. In addition to astrology, he consulted Alistair Crowley's Thoth Tarot, which has an astrological dimension. He immersed himself in several occult writers, including Crowley, Eliphas Levi, an astrologer, Evangeline Adams, and attempted magic rituals. Talbot was a regular churchgoer before his mental health broke down. While ill, he thought he was hunting a literal embodiment of evil, the devil. Alistair Crowley, who seems to have influenced Talbot more than anyone else, called himself Baphomet, and also connected Baphomet both with the devil and the sign of Capricorn. This is probably where Talbot got the idea that Margot's killer was a Capricorn. Most of what's in the notebook is worthless, but I think Talbot left 3. Strike now deleted the number 3 and substituted 4. As ever, when immersed in work, he felt a craving for a cigarette. As though in rebellion against the very idea, his lungs immediately treated him to a violent fit of coughing that necessitated the grabbing of kitchen roll to catch what they were trying to expel. Suitably chastened and shivering slightly, Strike drew his dressing gown more tightly around him, took a sip of tea he couldn't taste, and continued to work. Most of what's in the notebook is worthless, but I think Talbot left 4 possibly genuine leads out of the official police record, only recording them in the true book, i.e. his leather notebook. Symbol key. There are no names in the notebook, only zodiacal signs. I'm not listing unidentified eyewitnesses. We've got no chance of tracing them on their star signs and nothing else. But by cross-referencing corroborative details, these are my best guesses at the identity of people Talbot thought were important to the investigation. Aries, Paul Satchwell, ex-boyfriend. Taurus, Wilma Bayliss, office cleaner. Gemini, Una Kennedy. Gemini 2, Amanda Laws, saw M at window. Cancer, Janice Beattie, nurse. Cancer 2, Cynthia Phipps, Anna's nanny stroke stepmother. Leo, Dinesh Gupta, GP. Leo 2, Willie Lomax, saw M entering church. Leo 3, from Talbot's notes, Leo seems to have been seen coming out of the practice by a member of the public. Hints that Leo is known to police and that Leo was there at night. Strike now deleted the last paragraph and substituted a name and a new note. Leo 3. Nico Mucky Ricci. Gangster who attended practice Christmas party. Nobody seems to have recognized him except an unnamed passerby. Virgo. Dorothy Oakden, practice secretary. Libra. Joseph Brenner, GP. Libra 2. Ruby Elliott saw 2 struggling women. Scorpio, (?) dead person. I suggest an identity for Scorpio, but could be someone we haven't yet heard of. Scorpio 2, Mrs. Fleury, was leading elderly mother across Clerkenwell Green on evening of Margot's disappearance. Sagittarius, Gloria Conti, receptionist. Sagittarius 2, Jules Bayliss, husband of cleaner. Aquarius, Margot Bamborough, victim. Capricorn, the Essex butcher, stroke Baphomet. Pisces, Stephen Douthwaite, patient. Symbol, no idea, Roy Phipps, husband. Symbol, no idea, Irene Bull, stroke Hickson, receptionist. No idea what either of these symbols mean. Can't find them on any astrological website. Talbot seems to have invented them. If he'd stuck to birth signs, Irene would have been one of the Geminis and Roy would have been a Capricorn. Talbot writes that Phipps can't be true Capricorn because he's resourceful, sensitive, musical, then comes up with his new symbol for him on the advice of Schmidt. Schmidt. The name Schmidt is all over the notebook. Schmidt corrects to different star sign. Schmidt changes everything. Schmidt disagrees. Schmidt mostly wants to change people's star signs, which you'd think would be one certainty, given that birth dates don't change. I've checked with Gregory Talbot, and he can't remember his father ever knowing anyone of the name. My best guess is that Schmidt might have been a figment of Talbot's increasingly psychotic imagination. Perhaps he couldn't help noticing people weren't matching the star sign's supposed qualities, and Schmidt was his rational side trying to reassert itself. Possible leads. Joseph Brenner. In spite of Talbot's early determination to clear Brenner of suspicion on the basis of his star sign, Libra is the most trustworthy of the signs, according to Evangeline Adams. He later records in the notebook that an unidentified patient of the practice told Talbot that he, stroke she, saw Joseph Brenner inside a block of flats on Skinner Street on the evening Margot disappeared. This directly contradicts Brenner's own story. He went straight home. His sister's corroboration of that story, and possibly the story of the dog-walking neighbour who claims to have seen Brenner through the window at home at 11 in the evening. No time is given for Brenner's alleged sighting in Michael Cliff House, which was a 3-minute drive from the St. John's practice, and consequently far nearer Margot's route than Brenner's own house, which was a 20-minute drive away. None of this is in the police notes, and it doesn't seem to have been followed up. Death of Scorpio. Talbot seems to suggest that somebody died, and that Margot may have found the death suspicious. Scorpio's death is connected to Pisces, Douthwaite, and Cancer, Janus, which makes the most likely candidate for Scorpio, Joanna Hammond, the married woman Douthwaite had an affair with, who allegedly committed suicide. The Hammond-Douthwaite-Janus explanation fits reasonably well. Margot could have voiced suspicions about Hammond's death to Douthwaite the last time she saw him, which gives us the reason he stormed out of her surgery. And, as a friend, neighbour of Douthwaite's, Janice might have had her own suspicions about him. The problem with this theory is that I've looked up Joanna Hammond's birth certificate online, and she was born under Sagittarius. Either she isn't the dead person in question, or Talbot mistook her date of birth. Blood at the Phipps House. Roy Walking. When Lawson took over the case, Wilma the cleaner told him she'd seen Roy walking in the garden on the day Margot disappeared, when he was supposed to be bedbound. She also claimed she found blood on the spare bedroom carpet and cleaned it up. Lawson thought this was the first time Wilma had mentioned either fact to the police, and he suspected she was trying to make trouble for Roy Phipps. However, turns out Wilma did tell Talbot the story, but instead of recording it in the official police record, he put it in his astrological notebook. Even though Wilma had already given him what you'd think is significant information, Talbot's notes indicate that he was sure she was concealing something else. He seems to have developed a fixation with Wilma having occult powers, secret knowledge. He speculates that Taurus might have magic, and even suggests the blood on the carpet might have been put there by Wilma herself for some ritual purpose. Tarot cards associated with Taurus, Wilma's sign, came up a lot when he was using them, and he seems to have interpreted them to mean she knew more than she was letting on. He underlined the phrase Black Phantom in regard to her, and associated her with Black Lilith, which is some astrological fixed point associated with taboos and secrets. In the absence of any other explanation, I suspect a good slug of old-fashioned racism. Out on the Charing Cross Road, a car passed blaring from its radio, "Do They Know It's Christmas?" Frowning, Strike added another bullet point to possibly genuine new information, and began to type. Nico Mucky Ricci. According to Talbot, Leo III was seen leaving the practice one night by an unnamed passerby, who told Talbot about it afterwards. Nico Mucky Ricci was caught on camera in one of Dorothy Ogden's photos of the practice Christmas party in 1973. The pictures reproduced in her son's book. Ricci was a Leo, confirmed by DOB in press report from 1968. Ricci was a professional gangster, pornographer and pimp, who in 1974 was living in Leather Lane, Clerkenwell, a short walk from the St. John's practice, so should have been registered with one of the doctors there. He's now in his 90s and living in a nursing home, according to Shanker. The fact that Ricci was at the party isn't in the official record. Talbot found the fact Ricci was at the practice significant enough to write down in the astrological notebook, but there's no sign he ever followed it up or told Lawson about it. Possible explanations. 1. As Ricci was Leo, not Capricorn, Talbot concluded he couldn't be Baphomet. 2. Talbot didn't trust the person who said he'd seen Ricci leaving the building. 3. Talbot knew, but didn't record in his book, that Ricci had an alibi for that night Margot disappeared. 4. Talbot knew Ricci had alibis for other Essex butcher abductions. Whichever applies, the presence of Ricci at that party needs looking into. He's a man who had the contacts to arrange a permanent disappearance. See action points below. It cost Strike far more effort than it would usually have done to organize his thoughts on Mucky Ricci and set them down. Tired now, his throat raw and his intercostal muscles aching from coughing, he read through the rest of the document, which in his opinion contained little of real value other than the action points. After correcting a couple of typos, he attached the lot to an email and sent it to Robin. Only after this had gone did it occur to him that some people might think emailing work colleagues on Christmas Day was unacceptable. However, he shrugged off any momentary qualms by telling himself that Robin was currently enjoying a family Christmas and would be highly unlikely to check her email until tomorrow at the earliest. He picked up his mobile and checked it. Charlotte hadn't texted again. Of course, she had twins, aristocratic in-laws, and a husband to keep happy. He set the phone down again. Little energy, though he had, Strike found the absence of anything to do still more enervating. Without much curiosity, he examined a couple of the Christmas presents lying beside him, both of which were clearly from grateful clients, as they were addressed to both him and Robin. Shaking the larger one, he deduced that it contained chocolates. He returned to his bedroom and watched a bit of television, but the relentless emphasis on Christmas depressed him, and he switched off midway through a continuity announcer's wish that everyone was having a wonderful... Strike returned to the kitchen, and his gaze fell on the heavy projector and can of film lying just inside the door. After a moment's hesitation, he heaved the heavy machine onto his kitchen table, facing a blank stretch of kitchen wall, and plugged it in. It seemed to be in working order. He then prized the lid off the tin to reveal a large roll of 16mm film, which he took out and fitted into the projector. Doubtless because he wasn't thinking as clearly as usual, and also because of the need to stop regularly to cough up more sputum into kitchen roll, it took Strike nearly an hour to work out how to operate the old projector, by which time he realized that he had regained something of an appetite. It was now nearly 2 o'clock. Trying not to imagine what was going on in St. Maur's, where a large turkey with all the trimmings was doubtless reaching the peak of bronzed perfection, but seeing this flicker of returned appetite as a sign of returning health, he took the pack of out-of-date chicken and the limp vegetables out of the fridge, chopped it all, boiled up some dried noodles, and made a stir-fry. He could taste nothing, but this second ingestion of food made him feel slightly more human. And ripping the paper and cellophane off the box of chocolates, he ate several of them too, before flicking the switch on the projector. Onto the wall, pale in the sunlight, flickered the naked figure of a woman. Her head was covered in a hood. Her hands were bound behind her. A man's black-trousered leg entered the shot. He kicked her. She stumbled and fell to her knees. He continued to kick until she was prone on the ground of what looked like a warehouse. She'd have screamed, of course. She couldn't have failed to scream. But there was no soundtrack. A thin scar ran from beneath her left breast down to her ribs, as though this wasn't the first time knives had touched her. All the men involved had covered their faces with scarves or balaclavas. She alone was naked. The men merely pulled down their jeans. She stopped moving long before they had finished with her. At one point, close to the end, when she was barely moving, when blood still dripped from her many stab wounds, the left hand of a man who seemed to have watched, but not participated, slid in front of the camera. It bore something large and gold. Strike flicked off the projector. He was suddenly drenched in cold sweat. His stomach was cramping. He barely made it to the bathroom before he vomited, and there he remained, heaving until he was empty, until dusk fell beyond the attic windows. Chapter 30. Ah, dearest dame, quoth then the Paynim bold, pardon the error of enraged wight, whom great grief made forget the reins to hold of reason's rule. Edmund Spenser, The Fairy Queen. Annabel was wailing in Stephen's old bedroom, which was next door to Robin's own. Her niece had cried through a substantial portion of Christmas night, and Robin had been awake along with her, listening to Joni Mitchell on her headphones to block out the noise. 4 days stuck in her parents' home in Masham had driven Robin back to Mitchell's sprawling, wandering tunes and lyrics that had made her feel strangely lost. Margot Bamborough had found something there she had needed, and hadn't Margot Bamborough's life been far more complicated than her own? Ailing parents to support, a new daughter to love and to miss, a workplace full of cross-currents and bullying, a husband who wouldn't talk to her, another man lurking in the background, promising that he'd changed. What were Robin's troubles compared to those? So Robin lay in the dark and listened as she hadn't on the train. Then she had heard an alienating sophistication in the words the beautiful voice had sung. Robin hadn't had glamorous love affairs she could atomize or lament. She'd had one proper boyfriend and one marriage, which had gone horribly wrong. And now she was home at her parents' house, a childless 29-year-old who was travelling in a different direction to the rest of us. In other words, backwards. But in the darkness, really listening, she began to hear melodies among the suspended chords, and as she stopped comparing the music to anything she would usually have listened to, she realized that the images she had found alienating in their strangeness were confessions of inadequacy and displacement, of the difficulty of merging two lives, of waiting for the soulmate who never arrived, of craving both freedom and love. It was with a literal start that she heard the words at the beginning of track 8, I'm always running behind the times, just like this train. And when later in the song Mitchell asked, what are you going to do now? You've got no one to give your love to. Tears started in Robin's eyes. Not a mile from where she lay, Matthew and Sarah would be lying in bed in her ex-father-in-law's spare room, and here was Robin, alone again in a room that for her would forever have a hint of prison cell about it. This was where she had spent months after leaving university, pinioned within four walls by her own memories of a man in a gorilla mask, and the worst 20 minutes of her life. Since arriving home, everyone in the house had been keen to accompany her into Masham, because you shouldn't have to hide. The implication, no matter their kind intention, was that it would be a natural response for a woman whose ex-husband had found a new partner to hide. There was shame in being single. But listening to Court and Spark, Robin thought that it was perfectly true that she was travelling in a different direction to anyone she knew. She was fighting her way back to the person she should have been before a man in a mask reached for her from the darkness beneath a stairwell. The reason nobody else understood was that they assumed that her true self was to be the wife Matthew Cunliffe had wanted, a woman who worked quietly in HR and stayed home safely after dark. They didn't realize that that woman had been the result of those 20 minutes, and that the authentic Robin might never have emerged if she hadn't been sent, by mistake, to a shabby office in Denmark Street. With a strange sense of having spent her sleepless hours fruitfully, Robin turned off her iPod. 4 o'clock on Boxing Day morning, and the house was silent at last. Robin took out her earbuds, rolled over, and managed to fall asleep. 2 hours later, Annabel woke again, and this time Robin got up and crept downstairs barefooted to the big wooden table beside the Arga, carrying her notebook, her laptop, and her phone. It was pleasant to have the kitchen to herself. The garden beyond the window, covered in hard frost, was dark blue and silver in the winter pre-dawn. Setting her laptop and phone on the table, she greeted Roundtree, who was too arthritic these days for early morning frolicking, but wagged his tail lazily from his basket beside the radiator. She made herself a cup of tea, then took a seat at the table and opened her laptop. She hadn't yet read Strike's document summarizing the horoscope notes, which had arrived while she was busy helping her mother cook Christmas lunch. Robin had been adding the Brussels sprout to the steamer when she saw, out of the corner of her eye, the notification on her phone, which was charging on one of the few PowerPoints that wasn't taken up by some piece of baby equipment. Bottle sterilizer, baby alarm, or breast pump. Seeing Strike's name, her heart had momentarily lifted, because she was sure that she was about to read thanks for the gift of the Tom Waits DVD, and the fact that he'd emailed on Christmas Day was an indicator of friendship such as she had perhaps never received from him. However, when she opened the email, she simply read, FYI, Summary of Talbot's Horoscope Notes and Action Points. Robin knew her face must have fallen when she looked up and saw Linda watching her. Bad news?
No, just Strike.
On Christmas Day? Said Linda sharply. And Robin had realized in that instant that Geoffrey, her ex-father-in-law, must have been spreading it around Masham that if Matthew had been unfaithful, it was only after being heinously betrayed himself. She read the truth in her mother's face, and in Jenny's sudden interest in Annabel, whom she was jiggling in her arms, and in the sharp look flung at her by Jonathan, her youngest brother, who was tipping bottled cranberry sauce into a dish. "It's work," Robin had said coldly. Each of her silent accusers had returned hastily to their tasks. It was therefore, with very mixed feelings towards the author, that Robin now settled down to read Strike's document. Emailing her on Christmas Day had felt reproachful, as though she'd let him down by going back to Masham instead of remaining in London and single-handedly running the agency while he, Barclay and Morris, were down with flu. Moreover, if he was going to email at all on Christmas Day, some kind of personal message might be seen as common politeness. Perhaps he'd simply treated her Christmas present with the same indifference she treated his. Robin had just read to the bottom of possible leads and was digesting the idea that a professional gangster had been, on at least one occasion, in close proximity to Margot Bamborough, when the kitchen door opened, admitting baby Annabel's distant wails. Linda entered the room, wearing a dressing gown and slippers.
"What are you doing down here?"
she asked, sounding disapproving, as she crossed to the kettle. Robin tried not to show how irked she felt. She'd spent the last few days smiling until her face ached, helping as much as was physically possible, admiring baby Annabel until she doubted that a paw had been left unpraised. She joined in charades and poured drinks and watched films and unwrapped chocolates or cracked nuts for Jenny, who was constantly pinned to the sofa by the demands of breastfeeding. She'd shown an intelligent and sympathetic interest in Jonathan's university friend's exploits. She'd listened to her father's opinions on David Cameron's agricultural policy, and she'd noticed, but shown no resentment about, the fact that not a single member of her family had asked what she was doing at work. Was she not allowed to sit quietly in the kitchen for half an hour while Annabel rendered sleep impossible?
"Reading an email," said Robin. "They think," said Linda,
and Robin knew they must be the new parents, whose thoughts and wishes were of all-consuming importance just now.
"It was the sprouts. She's been colicky all night. Jenny's exhausted."
"Annabel didn't have sprouts," said Robin.
"She gets it all through the breast milk," explained Linda,
with what felt to Robin like condescension for being excluded from the mysteries of motherhood. Bearing two cups of tea for Stephen and Jenny, Linda left the room again. Relieved, Robin opened her notebook and jotted down a couple of thoughts that had occurred to her while reading possible leads, then returned to Strike's document to read his short list of probably irrelevant items gleaned from Talbot's notebook. Paul Satchwell. After a few months, Talbot's mental state clearly deteriorated, judging by his notes, which become progressively more detached from reality. Towards the end of the notebook, he goes back to the other two horn signs of the zodiac, Aries and Taurus, presumably because he's still fixated on the devil. As stated above, Wilmer comes in for a lot of unfounded suspicion, but he also goes to the trouble of calculating Satchwell's complete birth horoscope, which means he must have got a birth time from him. Probably means nothing, but strange that he went back to Satchwell and spent this much time on his birth chart, which he didn't do for any other suspect. Talbot highlights aspects of the chart that supposedly indicate aggression, dishonesty, and neuroses. Talbot also keeps noting that various parts of Satchwell's chart are same as AC, without explanation. Roy Phipps and Irene Hickson. As mentioned above, the signs Talbot uses for Roy Phipps and Irene Hickson, who was then Irene Bull, haven't ever been used in astrology, and seem to be inventions of Talbot's. Roy's symbol looks like a headless stick man. Exactly what it's supposed to represent I can't find out. Presumably a constellation. Quotations about snakes recur around Roy's name. Irene's invented sign looks like a big fish, and... The kitchen door opened again. Robin looked around. It was Linda again. "You still here?" she said, still with a slight sense of disapproval. "No," said Robin. "I'm upstairs." Linda's smile was reluctant. As she took more mugs from the cupboard, she asked, "Do you want another tea?" "No, thanks," said Robin, closing her laptop. She decided to finish reading Strike's document in her room. Maybe she was imagining it, but Linda seemed to be making more noise than usual. "He's got you working over Christmas as well, then," said Linda. For the past 4 days, Robin had suspected that her mother wanted to talk to her about Strike. The looks she'd seen on her surprised family's faces yesterday had told her why. However, she felt under no obligation to make it easy for Linda to interrogate her.
"As well as what?" asked Robin. "You know what I mean," said Linda. "Christmas. I'd have thought you were owed time off."
"I get time off," said Robin.
She took her empty mug over to the sink. Roundtree now struggled to his feet, and Robin let him out of the back door, feeling the icy air on every bit of exposed skin. Over the garden hedge, she could see the sun turning the horizon green as it made its way steadily up through the icy heavens.
"Is he seeing anyone?" Linda asked.
"Strike?"
"He sees lots of people," said Robin, willfully obtuse. "It's part of the job."
"You know what I mean," said Linda.
"Why the interest?"
She expected her mother to back off, but was surprised.
"I think you know why," she said, turning to face her daughter.
Robin was furious to find herself blushing. She was a 29-year-old woman. At that very moment, her mobile emitted a beep on the kitchen table. She was convinced that it would be Strike texting her, and so, apparently, was Linda, who, being nearer, picked up the phone to hand it to Robin, glancing at the sender's name as she did so. It wasn't Strike. It was Saul Morris. He'd written, "Hope you're not having as shit a Christmas as I am." Robin wouldn't normally have answered. Resentment at her family and something else, something she didn't particularly want to admit to, made her text back while Linda watched. "Depends how shit yours is. Mine's fairly shit." She sent the message, then looked up at Linda.
"Who's Saul Morris?" her mother asked.
"Subcontractor at the agency, ex-police," said Robin.
"Oh," said Linda.
Robin could tell that had given Linda fresh food for thought. If she was honest with herself, she'd meant to do exactly that. Picking her laptop off the table, she left the kitchen. The bathroom, of course, was occupied. Robin returned to her room. By the time she lay back down on her bed, laptop open again, Morris had texted her again. "Tell me your troubles and I'll tell you mine. Problem shared and all that." Slightly regretting that she'd answered him,
Robin turned the mobile face down on her bed and continued reading Strike's document. Irene's invented sign looks like a big fish, and Talbot's blunt about what he thinks it represents. The monster Cetus, Leviathan, the biblical whale, superficial charm, evil in depths. Headstrong, enjoys spotlight, a performer, a liar. Talbot seems to have suspected Irene was a liar even before she was proven to have lied about her trip to the dentist, which Talbot never found out about, although there's no indication as to what he thinks she was lying about. Margot as Babylon. This is only of relevance inasmuch as it shows just how ill Talbot was. On the night he was finally sectioned, he attempted some kind of magic ritual. Judging by his notes, he was trying to conjure Baphomet, presumably because he thought Baphomet would take the form of Margot's killer. According to Talbot, what manifested in the room wasn't Baphomet, but the spirit of Margot, who blames me, who attacks me. Talbot believed she'd become Babylon in death. Babylon being Baphomet's second in command, stroke consort. The demon he saw was carrying a cup of blood and a sword. There are repeated mentions of lions scribbled round the picture of the demon. Babylon rides a seven-headed lion on the card, representing lust in the Thoth Tarot. At some point after Talbot drew the demon, he went back and drew Latin crosses over some of the notes and on the demon itself, and wrote a biblical quotation warning against witchcraft across the picture. The appearance of the demon seems to have pushed him back towards religion, and that's where his notes end. Robin heard the bathroom door open and close. Now, desperate for a pee, she jumped up and headed out of her room. Stephen was crossing the landing, holding his wash bag, puffy-eyed and yawning. "Sorry about last night, Rob," he said. "Jenny thinks it was the sprouts."
"Yeah," Mum said,
Robin replied, edging around him.
"No problem. Hope she feels better." "We're going to take her out for a walk. I'll see if I can buy you some earplugs."
Once she'd showered, Robin returned to her room. Her phone beeped twice while she was dressing. Brushing her hair in the mirror, her eyes fell on the new perfume she'd received as a Christmas present from her mother. Robin had told her she was looking for a new fragrance because the old one reminded her too much of Matthew. She'd been touched that Linda remembered the conversation when she opened the gift. The bottle was round, not an orb, but a flattish circle. Chanel Chance Eau Fraîche. The liquid was pale green. An unfortunate association of ideas now made Robin think of sprouts. Nevertheless, she sprayed some on her wrists and behind her ears, filling the air with the scent of sharp lemon and nondescript flowers. What, she wondered, had made her mother choose it? What was it about the perfume that made her think Robin? To Robin's nostrils, it smelled like a deodorant, generic, clean, and totally without romance. She remembered her unsuccessful purchase of fracas and the desire to be sexy and sophisticated that had ended only in headaches. Musing about the disparity between the way people would like to be seen and the way others prefer to see them, Robin sat back down on her bed beside her laptop and flipped over her phone. Morris had texted twice more. "Lonely and hungover this end. Not being with the kids at Christmas is shit." When Robin hadn't answered this, he texted again. "Sorry, being a maudlin dickhead, feel free to ignore." Calling himself a dickhead was the most likable thing she'd ever known Morris do. Feeling sorry for him, Robin replied, "It must be tough. I'm sorry." She then returned to her laptop and the last bit of Strike's document, detailing actions to be taken, and with initials beside each to show which of them should undertake it. Action points. Talk to Gregory Talbot again. C.S. I want to know why, even after he got well, Bill Talbot never told colleagues about the leads in his notebook he'd withheld from colleagues during the investigation, i.e., sighting of Brenner in Skinner Street the night Margot disappeared, blood on the Phipps's carpet, a death Margot might have been worried about, Mucky Ricci leaving the practice one night.
speak to Dinesh Gupta again, CS. He might know who Brenner was visiting in Skinner Street that night, could have been a patient. He might also be able to shed light on Mucky Ricci appearing at the party. We'll also ask him about Scorpio, in case this refers to a patient whose death seems suspicious to Margot. Interview Roy Phipps, CS/RE. We've tiptoed around Phipps too long. Time to ring Anna and see whether she can persuade him to give us an interview. Try and secure interview with one of Wilma Bayliss's children, CS/RE. Especially important if we can't get to Roy. Want to re-examine Wilma's story. Roy walking, blood on the carpet. Find C.B. Oakden, CS/RE. Judging from his book, he's full of shit, but there's an outside possibility he knows things about Brenner we don't, given that his mother was the closest person to Brenner at the practice. Find and interview Paul Satchwell, CS/RE. Find and interview Stephen Douthwaite, CS/RE. Robin couldn't help but feel subtly criticised. Strike had now added his initials to action points that had previously been Robin's alone, such as finding Satchwell and persuading Wilma Bayliss's children to give them interviews. She set the laptop down again, picked up a phone, and headed back to the kitchen for breakfast. An abrupt silence fell when she walked into the room. Linda, Stephen, and Jenny all wore self-conscious looks of those who fear they might have been overheard. Robin put bread in the toaster, trying to tamp down her rising resentment. She seemed to sense mouthed speech and gesticulations behind her back. "Robin, we just ran into Matthew," said Stephen suddenly, "when we were walking Annabelle round the block."
"Oh,"
said Robin, turning to face them, trying to look mildly interested. It was the first time Matthew had been spotted. Robin had avoided midnight mass, out of conviction that he and Sarah would be there, but her mother had reported that none of the Cunliffs had attended. Now Linda, Stephen, and Jenny were all looking at her, worried, pitying, waiting for her reaction and her questions. Her phone beeped. "Sorry," she said, picking it up, delighted to have a reason to look away from them all. Morris had texted, "Why is your Christmas so shit?" While the other three watched, she typed back, "My ex-father-in-law lives locally, and my ex has brought his new girlfriend home. We're currently the local scandal." She didn't like Morris, but at this moment he felt like a welcome ally, a lifeline from the life she had forged, with difficulty, away from Matthew and Masham. Robin was on the point of setting down the phone when it beeped again, and still with the other three watching her, she read, "That stinks." "It does," she texted back. Then she looked up at her mother, Stephen, and Jenny, forcing herself to smile. "Do you want to tell me about it?" Robin asked Stephen. "Or do I have to ask?"
"No," he said hurriedly. "It wasn't much. We were just pushing Annabelle up to the square and back, and we saw them coming towards us. Him and that..."
"Sarah," supplied Robin. She could just imagine them hand in hand, enjoying the wintry morning, the picturesque town, sleepy in the frost and early sunshine.
"Yeah," said Stephen. "He looked like he wanted to double back when he saw us, but he didn't. Said, 'Congratulations in order, I see.'"
Robin could hear Matthew saying it.
"And that was it, really," said Stephen. "I'd like to have kicked him in the balls," said Jenny suddenly. "Smug bastard."
But Linda's eyes were on Robin's phone.
"Who were you texting back and forth on Boxing Day?" she asked. "I've just told you," said Robin. "Morris. He works for the agency."
She knew exactly what impression she was giving to Linda, but she had her pride. Perhaps there was no shame in being single, but the pity of her family, the thought of Matthew and Sarah walking through Masham, everyone's suspicion of her and Strike, and the fact that there was nothing whatsoever to tell about her and Strike, except that he thought he'd better start taking over some of her leads because she got no results, all made her want to clutch some kind of fig leaf to her threadbare dignity. Smarmy and over-familiar as he might be, Morris was today, perhaps, more to be pitied than censured, and was offering himself up to save Robin's face. She saw her mother and brother exchange looks, and had the empty satisfaction of knowing that they were already haring after her false scent. Miserable, she opened the fridge and took out half a bottle of carefully recorked champagne left over from Christmas Day.
"What are you doing?"
asked Linda.
"Making myself a mimosa," said Robin. "Still Christmas, isn't it?"
One more night, and she'd be back on the train to London. Almost as though she had heard Robin's antisocial thought, a cry of anguish issued through the baby monitor just behind her, making Robin jump. And what she was starting to think of as the baby circus relocated from the kitchen to the sitting room, Linda bringing a glass of water for Jenny to drink while breastfeeding, and turning on the TV for her, while Stephen ran upstairs to fetch Annabel. Drink, Robin decided, was the answer. If you splashed in enough orange juice, nobody had to know you were finishing off a bottle of champagne single-handedly. And those feelings of misery, anger, and inadequacy that were writhing in the pit of your stomach could be satisfactorily numbed. Mimosas carried her through to lunchtime, when everyone had a glass of red, although Jenny drank just a mouthful because of Annabel, and ignored Robin's suggestion that alcoholic breast milk might help her sleep. Morris was still texting, mostly stupid Christmas knock-knock jokes and updates on his day, and Robin was replying in the same mindless manner that she sometimes continued eating crisps with a trace of self-loathing. "My mother's just arrived. Send Sherry an excuse not to talk to her WI group about police work." "What's your mother's name?" Robin texted back. She was definitely a little bit drunk. "Fanny," said Morris. Robin was unsure whether to laugh or not, or indeed whether it was funny. "Robs, do you want to play Pictionary?" asked Jonathan.
"What?"
she said. She was sitting on an uncomfortable hard-back chair in the corner of the sitting room. The baby circus occupied at least half the room. The Wizard of Oz was on the television, but nobody was really watching.
"Pictionary," repeated Jonathan, holding up the box. "Oh, yeah, and Robs, could I come and stay with you for a weekend in February?"
"I'm only kidding," texted Morris. "Francis."
"What?"
Robin said again, under the impression somebody had asked her something.
"Morris is obviously a very interesting man," said Linda archly, and everyone looked round at Robin, who merely said, "Pictionary, yes, fine."
"Got to play Pictionary," she texted Morris. "Draw a dick," came back the instant answer. Robin set down her phone again. The drink was wearing off now, leaving in its wake a headache that throbbed behind her right temple. Luckily, Martin arrived at that moment with a tray full of coffees and a bottle of Baileys. Jonathan won Pictionary. Baby Annabel screamed some more. A cold supper was laid out on the kitchen table, to which neighbours had been invited to admire Annabel. By 8 o'clock in the evening, Robin had taken paracetamol and started to drink black coffee to clear her head. She needed to pack. She also needed, somehow, to shut down her day-long conversation with Morris, who, she could tell, was now very drunk indeed. "Motor gone home, complaining not seeing grandchildren enough. What shall we talk about now?"
"What are you wearing?"
She ignored the text. Up in her bedroom, she packed her case, because she was catching an early train.
"Please, God, let Matthew and Sarah not be on it."
She resprayed herself with her mother's Christmas gift. Smelling it again, she decided that the only message it conveyed to bystanders was, "I have washed." Perhaps her mother had bought her this boring floral antiseptic out of a subconscious desire to wipe her daughter clean of the suggestion of adultery. There was certainly nothing of the seductress about it, and it would forever remind her of this lousy Christmas. Nevertheless, Robin packed it carefully among her socks, having no wish to hurt her mother's feelings by leaving it behind. By the time she returned downstairs, Morris had texted another 5 times. "I was joking. Tell me you know I was joking. Fuck, have I offended you? Have I? Answer me either way, fuck's sake." Slightly riled and embarrassed now by her stupid adolescent pretense to her family that she, like Matthew, had found another partner, She paused in the hall to text back. I'm not offended. Got to go. Need an early night. She entered the sitting room, where her family were all sitting, sleepy and overfed, watching the news. Robin moved a muslin cloth, half a pack of nappies, and one of the Pictionary boards from the sofa, so she could sit down.
Sorry, Robin,
said Jenny, yawning as she reached out for the baby things and put them by her feet. Robin's phone beeped yet again. Linda looked over at her. Robin ignored both her mother and the phone, because she was looking down at the Pictionary board where Martin had tried to draw Icarus. Nobody had guessed it. They'd thought Icarus was a bug hovering over a flower. But something about the picture held Robin fixated. Again, her phone beeped. She looked at it. Are you in bed? Yes, and so should you be, she texted back, her mind still on the Pictionary board. The flower that looked like a sun. The sun that looked like a flower. Her phone beeped yet again. Exasperated, she looked at it. Morris had sent her a picture of his erect dick. For a moment, and even while she felt appalled and repulsed, Robin continued to stare at it. Then, with a suddenness that made her father start awake in his chair, she got up and almost ran out of the room. The kitchen wasn't far enough. Nowhere would be far enough. Shaking with rage and shock, she wrenched open the back door and strode out into the icy garden, with the water in the birdbath she'd unfrozen with boiling water, already milky hard in the moonlight. Without stopping to pause for thought, she called Morris's number.
Hey, how fucking dare you? How fucking dare you send me that?
Fuck, he said thickly. Wish you were here, or...
I said I was going to bloody bed! Robin shouted. I did not ask to see your fucking dick!
She could see the neighbours' heads bobbing behind their kitchen blinds. The Ellicotts were providing rich entertainment this Christmas, all right. First a new baby, then a shouting match about a penis.
Oh, shit, gasped Morris. Oh, fuck, no. Listen, I didn't mean...
Who the fuck does that? Shouted Robin. What's wrong with you?
No, shit, fuck, I'm sorry. I'm so fucking sorry, Robin. Don't. Oh, Jesus.
I don't want to see your dick.
A storm of dry sobs answered her. Then Robin thought she heard him lay down the phone on some hard surface. At a distance from the mouthpiece, he emitted moans of anguish interspersed with weeping. Heavy objects seemed to be falling over. Then there was a clatter, and he picked up his mobile again.
Robin, I'm so fucking sorry. What have I done? What have I... I thought I should fucking kill myself. Don't tell Strike, Robin. I'm fucking begging you. If I lose this job, don't tell Robin. I lose this, I lose fucking everything. I can't lose my little girls, Robin.
He reminded her of Matthew, the day she'd found out that he was cheating. She could see her ex-husband as clearly as though he were on the ice-crusted lawn, face in his hands, as he gasped his apologies. Then, looking up at her in panic, "Have you spoken to Tom? Does he know?" What was it about her that made men demand that she keep their dirty secrets? "I won't tell Strike," she said, shaking more with rage than with cold, "because his aunt's dying and we need an extra man. But you'd better never send me anything other than an update on a case again."
"Oh, God, Robin, thank you, thank you. You are such a decent person."
He'd stopped sobbing. His gushing offended her almost as much as the picture of his dick.
"I'm going."
She stood in the dark, barely feeling the cold, her mobile hanging at her side. As the light in the neighbour's kitchen went off, her parents' back door opened. Roundtree came lolloping over the frozen lawn, delighted to find her outside.
"You all right, love?"
Michael Ellicott asked his daughter.
"Fine,"
said Robin, crouching to fuss Roundtree to hide her sudden rush of tears.
"It's all fine."
Part 4. Great enemy is wicked time. Edmund Spenser, The Fairy Queen.
Chapter 31 Dear night, as dear as ever night was dear, that all these sorrows suffer for my sake, high heaven behold the tedious toil ye for me take. Edmund Spenser, The Faerie Queen. Strike's gastric upset added days to his illness, and he spent New Year's Eve in bed, reliant on takeaway pizzas, but hardly able to touch them when they arrived. For the first time in his life, he didn't fancy chocolate, because the truffles he'd consumed after his out-of-date chicken had been the first thing to reappear during his prolonged vomiting. The only enjoyable thing he did was to watch the DVD of Tom Waits's No Visitors After Midnight, the taped concerts Robin had bought him for Christmas, which he finally unwrapped on New Year's Day. His text thanking her elicited a short, "You're welcome." By the time he felt fit enough to travel down to Cornwall, clutching his belated Christmas gifts, Strike had lost over a stone, and this was the first thing an anxious Joan commented on when he finally appeared at her house in St. Mawes, full of apologies for his absence at Christmas. If he'd waited one more day to come down to Joan and Ted's, he'd have been unable to reach them, because no sooner had he arrived than a vicious weather front crashed over the south of Britain. Storms lashed the Cornish coast, train services were suspended, tons of sand washed off the beaches, and flooding turned the roads of coastal towns into freezing canals. The Cornish Peninsula was temporarily cut off from the rest of England, and while St. Mawes had not fared as badly as Mevagissey and Foy along the coast, sandbags had appeared at the entrances of buildings on the seafront. Waves smashed against the harbour wall, khaki and gunmetal grey. The tourists had melted out of sight like the seals. Locals in sodden oilskins greeted each other with nods as they made their way in and out of local shops. All the gaudy prettiness of summertime St. Mawes was wiped away, and, like an actress when the stage paint is removed, the town's true self was revealed, a place of hard stone and stiff backbone. Though pelted with rain and pummeled by gales, Ted and Joan's house was, mercifully, set on high ground. Trapped there, Strike remembered Lucy telling him he was better suited to a crisis than to keeping a commitment going, and knew that there was truth in the accusation. He was well suited to emergencies, to holding his nerve, to quick thinking and fast reactions, but found the qualities demanded by Joan's slow decline harder to summon. Strike missed the absence of an overriding objective, in pursuit of which he could shelve his sadness, missed the imperative to dismiss pain and distress in the service of something greater which had sustained him in the military. None of his old coping strategies were admissible in Joan's kitchen, beside the flowered casserole dishes and her old oven gloves. Dark humour and stoicism would be considered unfeeling by the kindly neighbours who wanted him to share and show his pain. Craving diversionary action, Strike was instead expected to provide small talk and homely acts of consideration. Joan was quietly delighted. Hours and days alone with her nephew were compensation for the Christmas he'd missed. Resigned, Strike gave her what she wanted, as much companionship as possible, sitting with her and talking to her all day long. Chemotherapy had been discontinued because Joan wasn't strong enough for it. She wore a headscarf over the wispy hair she had left, and her husband and nephew watched anxiously as she picked at food and held themselves constantly ready to assist her when she moved between rooms. Either of them could have carried her with ease now. As the days went by, Strike noticed another change in his aunt that surprised him. Just as her storm-ravaged birthplace had revealed a different aspect in adversity, so an unfamiliar Joan was emerging. A Joan who asked open-ended questions that were not designed to elicit confirmation of her own biases or thinly veiled requests for comforting lies.
"Why haven't you ever married, Cormoran?"
she asked her nephew at midday on Saturday morning, when they sat together in the sitting room, Joan in the comfiest armchair, Strike on the sofa. The lamp beside her, which they turned on because of the overcast rainy day, made her skin look as finely translucent as tissue paper.